presentable when he greeted them. He sank into the pool. The smooth floor was bliss against his weary soles. He remembered nothing after his arrival in Rorka. A vague recollection of a market returned to him, and a sense of being on the move, and then the inn. After that, a void. His beard had grown too thick for his liking, but there was no sign of a razor. When he was refreshed, he rose and drew on the bedgown that had been left on the nightstand. He startled when he saw her, a woman in a green cloak, holding a lamp in her palm. Her skin was a deep brown, like her eyes, and her hair spiraled around her face. "You must come with me." She spoke Innish with a Lassian accent. Loth shook himself. "Who are you, mistress?" "Chasar Uk Ispad invites you to his table." So the ambassador had found him, somehow. Loth wanted to ask more, but he had not the boldness in him to question this woman, who looked at him with a cool, unblinking gaze. He followed her through a series of windowless passages, carved out of rosy stone and lit with oil lamps. This must be where the ambassador lived, though it was nothing like the place Eid had described growing up. No open-air walkways or striking views of the Saras Mountains, just alcoves here and there, each framing a bronze statuette of a woman holding a sword and an orb. His guide stopped outside an archway, which was hung with a translucent curtain. "Through here," she said. She walked away, taking her light with her. The chamber beyond the veil was small, with a low ceiling. A tall Asiri man sat at a table. He wore a silver wrap around his head. When Loth entered, he glanced up. "Chasar Uk Ispad." "Lord Artaloth," the ambassador motioned to another seat. "Please, do sit down. You must be very tired." The table was piled with fruit. Loth sat in the opposite chair. "Ambassador Uk Ispad," he said a little hoarsely. "Is it you I should thank for saving my life?"
"I did vouch for you," was the reply. "But no, this is not my estate, and the remedy you took was not mine. In the spirit of Asiri hospitality, however, you may call me Chasar."
His voice was not as Loth remembered it. The Chasar Uk Ispad he had known at court had been full of laughter, not this unnerving calm.
"You are very lucky to be at this table," Chasar said. "Few men seek the priory and live to see it."
Another man poured Loth a cup of pale wine. "The priory, Your Excellency?" Loth asked, perplexed.
"You are in the priory of the orange tree, Lord Artaloth, in Lassia."
"Lassia? Surely not." "I was in Rorka," he said, still more perplexed. "How is that possible?"
"The Ichneumon," Chasar poured himself a drink. "They are old allies of the priory."
Loth was none the wiser.
"Aralak found you in the mountains." He put down his cup. "He summoned one of the sisters to collect you."
"The priory. The sisters."
"Aralak," Loth repeated. "The Ichneumon."
Chasar sipped his drink. Loth noticed for the first time that a sand eagle was perched nearby, its head cocked. Eid had praised these birds of prey for their intelligence.
"You look confused, Lord Artaloth," Chasar said lightly. "I will explain. To do that, I must first tell you a tale."
This was the strangest greeting in the world.
"You know the story of the damsel and the saint. You know how a knight rescued a princess from a dragon and took her away to a kingdom across the sea. You know that they founded a great city and lived happily ever after." He smiled. "Everything you know is false."
It was so quiet in the room that Loth heard the sand eagle ruffle its feathers.
"You are a follower of the Dawn Singer, Your Excellency," he finally said,
"but I ask that you do not blaspheme in front of me."
"The Berethnets are the blasphemers. They are the liars."
Loth was stunned into silence. He had known Chasar Uk Ispad was an unbeliever, but this came as a shock.
"When the Nameless One came to the south, to the city of Yekala," Chasar said, "High Ruler Selinu attempted to placate him by organizing a lottery of lives. Even children were sacrificed if their lot was drawn. His only daughter, Princess Cleolin, swore to her father that she could kill the beast, but Selinu forbade it. Cleolin was forced to watch as her people suffered. One day, though, she was chosen as the sacrifice.
This is as the Sanctarian tells it, Loth said.
Be silent and learn something.
Chasar selected a purple fruit from the bowl.
On the day that Cleolind was meant to die, a western knight rode through the city. He carried a sword named Ascalon.
Precisely.
Hush or I will cut out your tongue.
Loth closed his mouth.
This gallant knight, Chasar said, voice soaked in disdain, promised to kill the Nameless One with his enchanted sword. But he had two conditions. The first was that he would have Cleolind as his bride, and she would return to Iniska with him as his queen consort. The second was that her people would convert to the six virtues of knighthood, a code of chivalry that he had decided to turn into a religion with himself as its godhead, an invented faith. To hear the saint described like some roaming madman was too much to bear. Invented faith, indeed. The six virtues had been the code all Inish knights had lived by at that time. Loth opened his mouth, remembered the warning, and shut it again. Despite their fear, Chasar continued, the Lassian people did not want to convert to this new religion. Cleolin told the knight as much and refused both his terms. Yet Galleon was so overcome with greed and lust that he fought the beast nonetheless. Loth almost choked. There was no lust in his heart. His love for Princess Cleolind was chaste. Try not to be irritating, my lord. Galleon the Deceiver was a brute, a power-hungry, selfish brute. To him, Lassia was a field from which to reap a bride of royal blood and adoring devotees of a religion he had founded, all for his own gain. He would make himself a god and unite Iniska under his crown.
Chasar poured more wine while Loth seethed.
Of course, your beloved saint fell almost instantly with a trifling injury and pissed himself. And Cleolind, a woman of courage, took up his sword. She followed the Nameless One deep into the Lassian Basin, where he had made his lair. Few had ever dared enter the forest, for its sea of trees was vast and uncharted. She tracked the beast until she found herself in a great valley. Growing in this valley was an orange tree of astonishing height and untold beauty. The Nameless One was wrapped like a snake about its trunk. They fought across the valley, and though Cleolind was a powerful warrior, the beast set her afire. In agony, she crawled to the tree. The Nameless One crowed in triumph, certain of his victory, and opened his mouth to burn her once more, but while she was beneath the branches, his fire could not touch her. Even as Cleolind wondered at the miracle, the orange tree yielded its fruit. When she ate of it, she was healed. Not only healed, but changed. She could hear the whispers in the earth, the dance of the wind. She was reborn as a living flame. She fought the beast once more and plunged Ascalon beneath one of his scales. Grievously injured, the Nameless One slithered away. Cleolind returned in triumph to Yakala and banished Sir Galleon Berethnet from her land, returning his sword to him so he would never come back for it. He fled to the Isles of Iniska, where he told a false version of events, and they crowned him king of Loth slammed his fist down. The Sand Eagle shrieked in protest.
I will not sit at your table and listen to you sully my faith, Loth said quietly.
Cleolind went with him to Innis, and the Berethnet queens are their descendants.
Cleolind cast away her riches, Chasar said, as if Loth had not spoken, and journeyed back into the Lassian Basin with her handmaidens. There, she founded the Priory of the Orange Tree, a house of women blessed with the sacred flame. A house, Lord Artelof, of mages. Sorcery. The Priory's purpose is to slay worms and to protect the South from draconic power. Its leader is the Prioress, she who is most beloved of the Mother. And I'm afraid, Lord Artelof, that this great lady believes you may have murdered one of her daughters.
When Loth looked blank, Chasar leaned forward, his eyes intent. You were in possession of an iron box that was last held by a woman named Jondu.
I am no murderer. Jondu was captured by the Iskals, Loth insisted. Before she died, she entrusted the box to the Don Martyr of Iskalin, who gave it to me.
He groped for the back of the chair and stood up. She begged me to bring it to you.
You have it now, he said desperate. I must leave this place.
So Jandu is dead. Sit down, Lord Arteloff, Chassa said coolly. You will stay.
So you can insult my faith still further.
Because whomsoever seeks the priory can never leave its walls.
Loth turned cold.
This is a difficult thing to tell you, Lord Arteloff. I am acquainted with your lady mother, and it pains me to know that she will never see her son again. But you cannot leave. No outsider may. There is too great a risk that you could tell someone about the priory.
You, Loth shook his head. You cannot. This is madness.
It is a comfortable life. Not as comfortable as your life in Innis, Chassa admitted. But you will be safe here, away from the eyes of the world. I am the heir to Golden Birch. I am a friend to Queen Sabran the Ninth. I will not be mocked like this.
His back hit the wall.
He had always said you were a man of good humour. If this is some jest, Your Excellency, say it now.
Ah, Chassa sighed.
Eadaz, she told me of your friendship.
Something shifted inside Loth, and slowly he began to understand. Not Ead, but Eadaz. The feeling of sunlight, her secrets, her obscure childhood. But no, it could not be true. Ead had converted to the six virtues. She prayed at sanctuary twice a day. She could not be a heretic, a practitioner of the forbidden arts.
The woman you knew as Ead Durian is a lie, Arteloff. I devised that identity for her. Her true name is Eadaz Duzala Uknara, and she is a sister of the priory. I planted her in Innis under orders of the last prioress to protect Sabran the Ninth.
No. Ead, who had shared his wine and danced with him at every feast of fellowship since he was 22. Ead, the woman who his father had told him he should marry. Ead Durian.
She is a mage, one of the most gifted, Chassa said. She will return here as soon as Sabran births her child.
Every word drove the knife of betrayal deeper. He could take no more. He pushed through the curtain and blundered into the passages, only to come face to face with the woman in green. And he saw then that she was not holding an oil lamp. She was holding fire.
The mother is with you, Arteloff, she smiled at him. Sleep.
Chapter 33. East. They were ensconced in the highest room of Brickstad Palace, where they often stole a night alone when the High Prince was away. The walls were hung with tapestries, the window clammy with the heat of the fire. This was where the royals would give birth, beneath the starry vault. On other nights, they would abscond to the old quarter, to a room Janot held at an inn called the Sun in Splendour, which was known for its discretion. It sheltered many lovers who had fled from the laws of the Knight of Fellowship. Some, like Janot, were locked in marriages they had not chosen. Others were unwed. Others had fallen for people who were far above or below their station. All loved in a way that would see them pay a price in virtudom. That day, Edvard had set off with half the court, his daughter, and his nephew to the summer residence in the bridal forest. Janot had promised Edvard that they would join him soon to hunt the fabled Sanjin wolf that stalked the north of Mentendon. Niclaes had never been sure if Edvard knew the truth about his relationship with Janot. Perhaps he had closed his eyes to it. If the matter became public, the High Prince would have no choice but to banish Janot, his closest friend, for breaking his vow to the Knight of Fellowship. A log collapsed in the fire. Beside it, Janot was poring over his manuscripts, which were fanned across the rug in front of him. For the past few years, he had forsaken his art to pursue his passion for history. He had always been troubled by the calamitous loss of knowledge in the grief of ages, the burning of libraries, the destruction of archives, the irrevocable ruin of ancient buildings, and now that his son, Osgard, was taken on some duties in the duchy, he could finally lose himself in knitting the holes in history together. Niclaes lay naked in the bed, gazing at the painted stars. Someone had gone to a great deal of effort to make them mirror the true sky.
What is it?
Janot had not even needed to look up to know that something was wrong. Niclaes heaved a sigh.
A wyvern on the edge of our capital should dampen even your spirits.
3 days before, two men had ventured into a cave west of Brickstad and happened upon a slumbering wyvern. It was well known that draconic beings had found places to sleep all over the world after the grief of ages, and that if you looked hard enough in any country, you might be able to find one. In the Free State of Mentendon, the law declared that if discovered, these beasts should be left alone on pain of death. There was an ubiquitous fear that waking one could wake others, but these men had thought themselves above the law. Drunk on dreams of knighthood, they had drawn their swords and tried to kill the beast. Not best pleased with the rude awakening, it had eaten its attackers and clawed its way out of the cave in a fury. Too listless from its sleep to breathe fire, it had still managed to maul several residents of the nearby town before some brave soul put an arrow through its heart.
"Clay," Janot said. "It was two arrogant boys playing the fool. Ed will ensure it does not happen again."
"Perhaps dukes are naive to say such things, but there are arrogant fools the world over."
The Clays poured himself a glass of black wine.
"There was an abandoned mine not far from Rosenton, you know. Rumour had it among children that there was a cockatrice in there that had laid a clutch of golden eggs before it went to sleep. A girl I knew broke her back trying to get to it. A boy got himself lost in the darkness. He was never found. Arrogant fools, both."
"It amazes me that after all these years I'm still learning things about your childhood."
Janot arched an eyebrow, mouth quirked.
"Did you ever seek the golden clutch?"
Nicolay snorted. "The notion, ugh. I tiptoed to the entrance once or twice, but the love of your life was an abject coward, even as a boy. I feared death too much to seek it."
"Well, I can only be grateful for the softness of your spine. I confess to fearing your death, too.
I remind you that you are 2 years my senior, and that the arithmetic of death is against you."
Janot smiled. "Let us not speak of death when there is still so much life to be lived."
He stood, and the Clays drank in the powerful delineation of his body, sculpted by years of fencing. At 50, he was as striking as he had been on the day they had first met. His hair reached his waist, and it had darkened over time to a rich garnet, silvered at the roots. Nicolay still had no notion of how he had held on to this man's heart for all these years.
"Very soon I mean to whisk you away to the Milk Lagoon, and there we shall live without name or title."
Janot climbed onto the bed, hands on either side of Nicolay's, and kissed him.
"Besides, you are likely to die before me at this rate. Perhaps if you would stop cuckolding me with Ed's wine."
His hand snuck towards the glass.
"You have your dusty books, I have wine."
Chuckling, Nicolay's held it out of reach.
"We agreed."
"I see."
Janot made another half-playful swipe for it.
"And when did we agree this?"
"Today. You may have been asleep." Janot gave up and rolled onto the bed beside him. Nicolay's tried to ignore the tug of remorse. They had quarrelled about his weakness for wine many times over the years. He had curbed his drinking enough to stop him losing hours of memory, as he often had in his youth, but his hand shook if he went too long without a cup. Janot seemed too weary of the subject to fight him on it these days. It hurt Nicolay's to disappoint the one person who loved him. Black wine was his comfort. Its thick sweetness filled the hollow that opened whenever he looked at his finger, empty of a love not ring. It blunted the pain of living a lie.
"Do you really think the Milk Lagoon exists?" he murmured.
"A place of lore and lullaby, the haven for lovers." Janot circled his navel with one finger.
"I do," he said. "I have gathered enough evidence to believe it existed before the grief of ages, at least.
Ed has heard that the remaining scions of the family of Nerefris know where it is, but they will tell only the worthy."
"That rules me out, then. You had better go alone. You are not getting away from me that easily, Nicolay's ruse."
Janot shifted his head closer, so their noses brushed.
"Even if we never find the Milk Lagoon, we can go elsewhere."
"Where?"
"Somewhere else in the south, perhaps. Anywhere the Knight of Fellowship has no sway," Janot said. "There are uncharted places beyond the Gate of Ungulus, perhaps other continents.
I am no explorer.
You could be, Clay. You could be anything, and you should never think otherwise."
Janot rolled a thumb over Nicolay's cheekbone.
"If I had convinced myself I was no sinner,
I would never have kissed the lips I longed to kiss, the lips of a man with rose-gold hair, whose birth, by the laws of a long-dead knight, made him unworthy of my love. Nicolas tried not to stare like a fool into these grey, vatten eyes. Even now, after all these years, looking at this man took his breath away.
"What of Aladdin?" he said.
He tried to sound curious rather than sour. It was difficult for Janot, who had spent decades stealing between companion and lover, at great risk to his standing at court. Nicolas had no such care. He had never wed, and nobody had tried to force him.
"Ellie will be fine," Janot said, even as his brow crinkled. "She will be the Dowager Duchess of Zeodor, wealthy and powerful in her own right."
Janot cared about Aladdin. Even if he had never loved her as companions loved, they had fostered a close friendship in their 30-year marriage. She had handled his affairs, carried his child, run the Duchy of Zeodor at his side, and throughout it all, she had loved him unconditionally. When they left, Nicolas knew Janot would miss her. He would miss the family they had made, but in his eyes, he had given them his youth. Now he wanted to live out his last years with the man he loved. Nicolas reached for his hand, the one that bore a silver love-knot ring.
"Let's go soon," he said lightly, to distract him. "Hiding like this is beginning to age me."
"Age becomes you, my golden fox," Janot kissed him. "We will be gone, I promise."
"When?"
"I want to spend a few more years with Trude, so she has some memory of her grandsire."
The child was only 5 years old, and already she would leaf ham-fisted through whatever tome Janot set in front of her, bottom lip stuck out in determination. She had his hair.
"Liar," Nicolas said. "You want to make sure she carries on your legacy as a painter, since Oscard has no artistic skill." Janot laughed richly. "Perhaps."
They lay still for a while, fingers intertwined. The sunlight washed the room in gold. They would be alone together soon. Nicolas told himself that it was true, as he had every day for year after year. Another year, perhaps two, until Trude was a little older. Then they would leave Virtudin behind. When Nicolas turned to look at him, Janot smiled, that roguish smile that teased at one corner of his mouth. Now he was older, it made his cheek crease in a way that somehow only served to make him more beautiful. Nicolas raised his head to meet the kiss, and Janot cradled his face in both hands as if he were framing one of his portraits. Nicolas drew a line down the white canvas of Janot's stomach, making his body arch closer and quicken. And even though they knew each other by heart, the strength of this embrace felt new. By the time dusk fell, they lay entwined in front of the fire, heavy-eyed and slippery with sweat. Janot skimmed his fingers through Nicolas' hair.
"Clay," he murmured, "I must go away for a while."
Nicolas looked up.
"What?" "You wonder what I do in my study all day," Janot said. "A few weeks ago, I inherited a fragment of text from my aunt, who was Viceroy of Orisima for 40 years.
Nicolas sighed. Once Janot was in pursuit of a mystery, he was like a crow on a carcass, driven by his nature to pick every bone clean. As Nicolas craved alchemy and wine, Janot craved the restoration of knowledge.
"Do tell me more," Nicolas said, as gamely as he could.
"The fragment is many centuries old. I almost fear to handle it in case it falls apart. According to her journal, my aunt received it from a man who told her to carry it far from the east and never bring it back."
"How mysterious."
Nicolas couched his head on his arms.
"What has this got to do with your going away?"
"I cannot read the text. I must go to the University of Ostendia to see if anyone knows the language. I think it is an ancient form of Psychonese, but something about the characters sit oddly with me. Some are larger, others smaller, and they are spaced in a strange manner."
His voice was distant.
"There is a hidden message in it, Clay. Intuition tells me that it is a vital piece of history, something of more importance than anything I have studied before. I must understand it. I have heard of a library of people that might help me do that."
"Where is this place, exactly?" Nicolas asked. "Is it part of the university?"
"No. It is rather isolated, a few miles from Wilgastrom."
"Oh, Wilgastrom, thrilling."
It was a sleepy town on the River Lint. No wyverns there.
Well, come back soon. The moment you leave, Ed tries to involve me in hunting or battledore or some other pastime that involves talking to courtiers.
Janar pressed closer.
You will survive.
His smile faded, and just for a moment, there was darkness in his eyes.
I would never leave you without reason, Clay, on my oath.
I will hold you to it, Zeodir.
There existed a realm between dreaming and waking, and Niclaes was imprisoned in it. As he stirred, a tear squeezed from the corner of his eye. Rain dusted his face. He was in a rowing boat, swayed like an infant in a cradle. Figures hunkered around him, trading words, and a fearsome thirst blazed in his throat. Dim memories swam at the back of his mind, hands dragging him, food being shoveled between his lips, almost choking him, a cloth over his nose and mouth. He groped for the side of the boat and retched. All around the vessel were green waves, clear as forest glass.
Saint! His voice was dry. Water! He said in Cycones. Please!
Nobody answered. It was twilight, or dawn. The sky was bruised with cloud, but the sun had left a finger smear of honey. Niclaes blinked the rain from his eyes and beheld the fire-orange sails that loomed over the boat, illuminated by scores of lanterns. A ghost ship, wreathed in sea mist. One of his captors slapped him across the head and barked something in Lacustrine.
All right, Niclaes murmured, all right.
He was heaved up by the ropes that bound his wrists and forced at knife point to a ladder. The sight of the ship undid his jaw and shook the last of the drows from him. A 9-masted galleon, its hull banded with iron, at least twice the length of a high western. Niclaes had never seen a ship as colossal as this, not even in Innish waters. He placed his bare feet on the wooden slats and climbed, chased by shouts and jeers. He was among pirates, undoubtedly. From the jade green of the waves, this was most likely the Sundancy, which bled into the abyss. The dark ocean that separated east from west and north and south. This was the sea he had crossed when he had sailed towards Psyche all those years ago. It would also be the sea he died in. Pirates were not known for their mercy or their civil treatment of hostages. It was a wonder he had made it this far without having his throat slit. At the top, he was led by his ropes across the deck. All around him were eastern men and women, with a handful of southerners scattered among them. Several of the pirates nailed suspicious looks on Niclaes, while others ignored him. Many had a Cycones word inked on their brows. Murder. Theft. Arson. Blasphemy. The crimes for which they had been punished. Niclaes was lashed to one of the masts, where he reflected on the misery of his condition. This had to be the largest ship in existence, which meant he had been snatched by the fleet of the Tiger Eye, pirates who specialized in the shadow market trade, in parts taken from dragons. They also, like all pirates, indulged in many other crimes. They had taken all his possessions, including the text Janot had died for, the fragment that was never supposed to have come back to the east. It was the last piece of him that Niclaes still possessed, and damn his soul, he had lost it. The thought made him want to weep, but he had to convince these pirates that they needed an old man. Sobbing in terror was not the way to achieve that end. It felt like months before somebody approached him. By that time, the sun was rising. A Lacustrine woman came to stand before him. Paint darkened her lips. Over her grizzled hair was a headdress, golden and heavy with razor-sharp ornaments, each a little work of art. At her side was a sword, just as golden and twice as sharp. The lines etched into her brown skin spoke of many years spent under the sun. She was flanked by 6 pirates, including a mustachioed giant of a Sepuli fellow, whose bare chest was so smothered in tattoos that there was no virgin skin left on him. Giant tigers ripped dragons apart across his torso, and the blood swirled amid sea foam to his shoulders. A pearl sat right over his heart. The leader, for leader she unquestionably was, wore a long coat of black water silk. Her missing right arm had been replaced by an articulated wooden substitute, complete with an elbow, fingers, and a thumb, fitted with a cage over her shoulder, and secured with a leather strap across her chest. Niclaes doubted it was much use to her in the heat of battle, but it was a remarkable innovation, quite unlike anything he had seen in the West. The woman regarded Niclaes, then marched back into the crowd of pirates, who parted to let her through.
The giant unraveled the ropes and bundled Nicolas into her cabin, which was decorated with swords and bloody flags. Two people stood in the corner, a thick-set woman with freckled brown skin and lines around her mouth, and a bone-thin man, tall and pale, who frankly looked ancient. A tunic of tattered red silk came past his knees. The pirate sprawled on a throne, accepted a wood and bronze pipe from the man, and inhaled whatever vapours were within. She considered Nicolas through a blue-tinged haze before addressing him in Lacustrine. Her voice was deep and measured.
"My pirates do not usually take hostages," the freckled woman translated into Cyclenese. "Except when we are short of seafarers." She arched an eyebrow at Nicolas. "You are special."
He knew better than to speak without permission, but inclined his head. The interpreter waited while the captain spoke again.
"You were found on the beach of Genura, carrying certain documents," the interpreter continued. "One of them is part of an ancient manuscript. How did you come into possession of this item?"
Nicolas bowed low. "Honoured captain," he said, addressing the Lacustrine woman. "It was bequeathed to me by a dear friend after his death. I brought it with me when I came to Psyche from the Free State of Mentendon, hoping to find some meaning behind it." His words were passed back to the woman in Lacustrine.
"And did you?" came the reply.
"Not yet." Her eyes were shards of volcanic glass.
"You have had this item for a decade, and carry it on your person like a talisman, but you say you know nothing about it. A fascinating claim," the interpreter said once the captain had spoken. "Perhaps a beating will inspire you to tell the truth. When a person vomits blood, secrets often spill out with it."
Sweat soaked his back.
"Please," he said, "it is the truth. Have mercy."
She laughed softly as she answered.
"I did not become the Lord of all Pirates by showing mercy to thieving liars."
Lord of all Pirates? This was not just any pirate captain. This was the dread sovereign of the Sundance Sea, the conqueror of myriad ships, a mistress of chaos with 40,000 pirates under her command. This was the Golden Empress, the enemy of order, who had clawed herself from poverty to construct her own nation on the waves, a nation beyond the dominion of dragons.
"All-honoured Golden Empress," Nicolas prostrated himself, "forgive me for not showing you the appropriate respect. I did not know who you were."
His knees screamed, but he kept his brow against the floor.
"Let me sail with you. I will give you my skills as an anatomist, my knowledge, my loyalty. I will do anything you ask, only spare my life."
The Golden Empress took up her pipe again.
"I would have asked your name had you proven the existence of your backbone," was her answer. "But you shall be called Seamoon now."
The pirates at the door roared with laughter. Nicolas winced. Seamoon, the Cyclenese term for quoll, a spineless jelly in the clutches of the current.
"You say you are an anatomist," the interpreter said to Nicolas, pausing every few moments to listen to the captain. "It so happens that I need a surgeon on this ship. My last one thought herself a cunning poisoner. She wanted vengeance for the ruin of her shit-heap of a village, so she dropped the gold silkworm into my wine."
The Golden Empress sipped from the pipe again, then breathed out a curl of smoke.
"She learned that salt water is just as deadly," Nicolas swallowed. "I do not like to waste what I can use. Prove your skill," the Golden Empress told him, "and we may talk again."
"Thank you," his voice split. "Thank you, all-honoured captain, for your mercy."
"This is not mercy, Seamoon. This is business."
She reclined in her seat and spoke again.
"Be sure to be loyal to me," the interpreter continued. "There are no second chances in the fleet of the Tiger Eye."
"I understand." Nicolas mustered his courage. "All-honoured Golden Empress, I have one more question to ask, if I may."
She glanced at him.
"Where is the dragon you took from the beach?"
"Below decks," came the translation. "Drunk on fire cloud, but not for long."
She raked her gaze over him.
"We will speak again soon, Seamoon. For now, you have your first surgery to perform."
Chapter 34. West. When it was formally proclaimed that Queen Sabran was with child, the people of Innis ceased their mourning and celebrated in the streets. Prince Albrecht was dead,
but by gifting them the next ruler of Virtudom, he had brought them another generation of safety from the Nameless One. Though she would traditionally stay in Briar House for half the year, no one grumbled when Sabran decreed that the court would return to Ascalon Palace for the remainder of her pregnancy. Every corridor in the winter residence was choked with memories of the Prince Consort, and it was commonly agreed that it was best for Queen Sabran to have a fresh outlook. New gowns were made to accommodate her condition. The lying-in chamber was aired for the first time in decades. The palace was a butterfly house of chatter, and with every meal, courtiers raised their cups to the queen. Laughter rang bright and loud as a bell. They did not see what the ladies of the bedchamber saw, the sickness that racked her at all hours. The relentless exhaustion, the way she lay awake at night, ill at ease with the change in her body. Now, Rosalind had told the ladies-in-waiting in private, was the most dangerous time in the pregnancy. Sabran was not to exert herself. She was not to hunt, or go on vigorous walks, or to harbour unhappy thoughts. They would all have to work together to keep her calm and in good spirits. The life of the child took precedence over that of the mother, since there was no evidence that the women of the House of Berethnic could conceive more than once. Little wonder Sabran had been withdrawn of late. The childbed was the one place where her divine authority would not protect her, and every day now brought her closer to it. If she needed further confirmation of the dangers that surrounded her, the Duke's spiritual saw fit to remind her daily. "It is vital that we decide on our course. Iskarlin could mount an invasion any day now," Igraine Crest said to her one morning. "Our coastal defences have been strengthened since Fyredale came, in accordance with your orders, but more is necessary. We received word that the Flesh King has been constructing a new fleet in Quarrel Bay. Some 50 ships are already built." It was a moment before Sabran spoke. An invasion fleet. There were horseshoes of shadow under her eyes. "I fear so, Majesty," Crest said, gentler. "As does your cousin, the Lord Admiral." The Duchess of Justice had arrived while Sabran was breaking her fast. She stood in a bar of sunlight, which glinted off her patron brooch. "We will open negotiations with Hroth immediately," she said. "The Wolfcoats will strike fear into Sagoso. To strengthen the chances of aid, we will, of course, take word that Your Majesty has at last accepted the long-standing offer from the Chieftain of Escardal. Once King Rhaenys hears..." "There will be no acceptance of Escardal," Sabran cut in. "King Rhaenys is a sovereign of Virtudom, and my distant relative. Let us see how many troops he offers us before we make any offers to him." Catrion pulled in a slow breath. It was unlike Sabran to interrupt Crest. Crest, too, looked as if she had been caught off guard. Nonetheless, she smiled. "Majesty," she said, "I do understand this must be difficult, given the recent death of Prince Albrecht, but I trust you will remember what I told you the day before your coronation. As a sword must be oiled, so a fellowship must be renewed. Best that you are not a distant relative to Rhaenys, but a near and dear one. You must wed again." Sabran gazed at the window. "I do not see the need for it now." Crest let her smile fall this time. Her attention darted first to Catrion, then to Eard. "Majesty," she said in a reasonable tone, "perhaps we could continue this conversation in private." "Why, Igraine?" Sabran asked evenly. "'Cause this is a sensitive diplomatic issue." After a delicate pause, she said, "If you will forgive us, Lady Catrion, Mistress Durian, I would like to speak to Queen Sabran alone." Eard curtsied and made to leave, as did Catrion, but Sabran said, "No, Eard, Kate, stay where you are." After a moment, they both stepped back into place. Sabran drew herself up in her chair and laid her hands on its arms. "Your Grace," she said to Crest, "whatever you wish to say of this matter, you may say in front of my ladies. They would not be standing in this chamber if I did not trust them absolutely." Eard exchanged a glance with Catrion. Crest forced another smile. "Regarding King Rhaenys," she continued, "we must have confirmation that His Majesty will commit to the defence of Innis. I will send Ambassador Stirbine to Elding at once, but it would strengthen his hand if he carried an acceptance of this suit." At this, Sabran laid a hand on her belly. "Igraine," she said, her voice quiet, "you have long stressed to me the need for an heir, my bounden duty,
To honour that, I will not take another companion, or even consider it while I am still with child, lest the strain of the matter harm my daughter.
Her gaze was piercing.
Offer Rainus anything else, and we will see what he offers us in return.
The evasion was clever. Crest could not dispute it without appearing to dismiss the well-being of the heir.
Majesty, she said, disappointment etched on her face, I can only advise. The choice and its consequences are yours.
She curtsied and left the privy chamber. Sabran looked after her, expressionless.
She pushes too hard, she said softly, once the doors were shut.
I never saw when I was younger. I revered her too much to see how much she hates to be denied. It is only that her grace believes she knows best, Catrian said, and she has a will to rival yours. My will was not always what it is now. Once I was as molten glass, yet to be spun into shape. I sense I have taken a shape she mislikes.
Don't be silly.
Catrian sat on the arm of her throne.
Let her grace drink her sour wine for a few days. She will come around, just as she did after you chose Prince Albrecht.
She gave Sabran the gentlest pat on the belly.
You must think only of this now.
2 days later, a signal beacon was fired in Perchling, warning of danger to the coast. Sabran received Lord Lemond Finch, her cousin, while she was still in her bedgown.
Majesty, I regret to inform you that the Umbora was sighted in the Swan Strait this morning, he said. Though it did not attack, the House of Italdo has clearly taken the measure of our coastal defences. As Lord Admiral, I have commanded your navy to keep any further scouts at bay. But I beg you, cuz, to ask King Rainus for support. His ships would be of great use in guarding our eastern coast.
Ambassador Stirbine is already on his way to Elding. I have also requested Hellburners from High Princess Ermuna in exchange for Innish support on her border with Iskallen, Sabran said. Should the Flesh King flick his tongue at our coast again, I bid you remind him why the Innish Navy is known as the greatest in the world.
Yes, Majesty.
You will also send mercenaries to Quarrel Bay. I expect them to be hand-chosen by you and indisputably loyal to Innis. Her eyes were hard as emeralds. I want his fleet torched.
Her cousin considered this.
A foray into draconic territory could incite an armed response.
The Knight of Courage bids us go forth into even the greatest danger in the interest of defending Virtudom, Your Grace. I see no reason why I should wait for bloodshed before I defend this isle, Sabran said. Send Sagoso a message. If he wants to dance with fire, it is he who will burn.
Finch bowed.
Majesty, I will see it done.
He marched back out. Two of the knights of the body closed the doors behind him.
If Iskallen courts war, I will oblige, but we must be ready, Sabran murmured. If Rainus is not in a generous mood, it may be my fate to make this marriage to the chieftain of Iskardal, for Innis.
Marriage to a man old enough to be her grandsire. Even Catrian, who was practiced in courtesy, creased her nose in distaste. Sabran crossed her arms over her midriff.
Come, Eard laid a hand on her back. Let us take the air while the snow is untouched.
Oh, yes.
Catrian rose to the occasion with relish.
We could pick some damsons and blackberries. And do you know, Sabran, Meg said she saw a dear little hedge pig a few days ago. Perhaps we can help the servants to chase the poor things from under the bale fires.
Sabran nodded, but her face was a mask, and Eard knew that, in her mind, she was trapped under a bale fire of her own, waiting for an unseen hand to set light to the kindling.
Not long after the announcement, Eard found herself once more in the privy chamber, embroidering roses on a baby cap. Since the scent of roses had kept her nightmares at bay, Sabran wanted them on everything her daughter would wear for the first days of her life. The queen lay on a couch in her padded bedgown. She had shed weight in the days following the ambush in Ascalon, making her belly impossible to miss.
I feel nothing, she said. Why does she not move?
That is natural, Majesty.
Roslaine was bordering one end of a swaddle blanket. Catrian worked on the other.
You may not feel her quicken for some time.
Sabran kept exploring the little round in her belly with her fingers.
I believe, she said, that I have a name for my daughter.
The chief gentlewoman looked up so quickly she must have given herself a cricked neck.
The blanket was forgotten as she and Catrion rushed to sit on either side of Sabran. Only Eard remained where she was.
"This is wonderful news, Sab."
Smiling, Catrion laid a hand over hers. "What have you chosen?" There were 6 historical names for Barethnet monarchs, Sabran and Jillian being the most popular.
"Sylvan. After Sylvan by the river," the queen said, "where her lord father died."
That name was not one of them. Roslane and Catrion exchanged a worried glance.
"Sabran," Roslane said, "it is not traditional. I do not think your people would take well to it."
"Am I not their queen? Superstition knows no rulers."
Sabran looked coldly towards the window.
"Kate?" "I agree, Your Majesty. Let the child not have the shadow of death over her head."
"And you, Eard?"
Eard wanted to support her. She should have the right to name her own child as she pleased, but the Inish did not take kindly to change.
"I agree." She pulled her needle through the cloth.
"Sylvan is a beautiful name, Majesty, but it may serve to make your daughter melancholy. Better to name her after one of your royal ancestors." At this, Sabran looked exhausted. She turned onto her side and pressed her cheek into the cushion.
"Glorian, then."
A grand name indeed. Since the death of Glorian Shieldheart, it had never been bestowed on any princess. Catrion and Roslane both made approving sounds.
"Her Royal Highness, Princess Glorian," Catrion said, with the air of a steward announcing her entrance. "It already suits her. What hope and heart it will give to your subjects."
Roslane nodded sagely. "It is high time such a magnificent name was resurrected." Sabran stared at the ceiling as if it were a bottomless chasm. Within a day, the news had seeped into the capital. Celebrations were planned for the day the princess was born, and the Order of Sanctarians prophesied the might of Glorian IV, who would lead Innis into a golden age. Eard watched it all with weary detachment. Soon, the prioress would call her home. Part of her longed to be among her sisters, united with them in praise of the mother. Another part wanted nothing but to remain. She had to crush it. There was something Eard had to do before she left. One evening, when the other ladies were occupied and Sabran was resting, she made her way to the Dern Tower, where Trude Ziadur remained imprisoned. The guards were on high alert, but she needed no siding to get into forbidden places. As the clock tower struck 11, she reached the highest floor. Dressed in naught but a soiled petticoat, the Marchioness of Ziadur was a shadow of the beauty she had been. Her curls were twisted and heavy with grease, and her cheekbones strained against her skin. A chain snaked between her ankle and the wall.
"Mistress Durian,"
her gaze was as intense as ever,
"have you come to crow over me?"
She had wept when she saw her prince lying dead. It seemed her grief had cooled.
"That would not be courteous," he had said, "and only the Knight of Justice can judge you."
"You know no saint, heretic."
"Rich words, traitor."
He had took in the piss-soaked straw.
"You do not look afraid."
"Why should I be afraid?"
"You are responsible for the death of the prince consort. That is high treason."
"You will find I am protected here as a Mentish citizen," Trude said. "The High Princess will try me in Brigstad, but I am confident I will not be executed. I am so young, after all."
Her lips were split.
Eard took a wineskin from her bodice, and Trude, after a moment, drank.
"I came to ask," Eard said, "what you thought you would achieve."
Trude swallowed the ale.
"You know," she wiped her mouth, "I will not tell you again."
"You wanted Sabran to fear for her life. You wanted her to feel as if there were too many battles for her to fight alone. You imagined that this would cause her to seek help from the east," Eard said. "Was it also you who let the cutthroats into Ascalon Palace?"
"Cutthroats?"
As a maid of honour, she would not have been told.
"Has someone tried to kill her before?"
Trude pressed. Eard nodded.
"Do you know the identity of this cup-bearer the shooter evoked?"
"No, as I told the Night Hawk," Trude looked away. "He says he will have the name from me one way or another." Eard found that she believed in her ignorance. Whatever her faults, the girl did appear to want to protect Innis. "The Nameless One will rise, as his servants have," Trude said. "Whether there is a queen in Innis or a son in the sky, he will rise." The chain had rubbed her ankle bloody. "You are a sorceress, a heretic. Do you believe the House of Barethnet is all that binds the beast?" Eard stopped the wineskin and sat.
I am not a sorceress, she said. I am a mage, a practitioner of what you might call magic. Magic is not real. It is, Eid said, and its name is Sidon. I used it to protect Sabran from Fyrdell. Perhaps that will confirm to you that we are on the same side, even if our methods differ. And even if you are a dangerous fanatic whose folly killed a prince. I never meant for him to die. It was all a mask. Wrong-headed outsiders poisoned it. Trude paused to cough pitifully. Still, Prince Albrecht's death does open a new avenue for an Eastern alliance. Sabran could marry an Eastern noble, the unceasing Emperor of the Twelve Lakes, perhaps. Give her hand and claim an army to kill every worm. Eid huffed a laugh. She would sooner swallow poison than share a bed with a worm lover. Wait until the Nameless One shows himself in Innis. Wait until her people see that the House of Berethnet is built on a lie. Some of them must already believe it. Trude raised her eyebrow. They have seen a High Western. They see that Iskallen is emboldened. Sigoso knows the truth. Eid held out the wineskin again. You have risked a great deal for this belief of yours, she said as Trude swallowed. There must be more to it than mere suspicion. Tell me what planted the seed. Trude withdrew, and for a long time Eid thought she would not answer. I tell you this, she finally said, only because I know no one will listen to a traitor. Perhaps it will plant a seed in you as well. She curled an arm around her knees. You are from Rumlabar. I trust you have heard of the ancient Skystone tablet that was unearthed in its mines. I know of it, Eid said. An object of alchemical interest. I first read about it in the library of Nicolay's Ruse, the dearest friend of my grandsire. When he was banished, he entrusted most of his books to me, Trude said. The Tablet of Rumlabar speaks of a balance between fire and starlight. Nobody has ever been able to interpret it. Alchemists and scholars have theorized that the balance is symbolic of the worldly and the mystic, of anger and temperance, of humanity and divinity. But I think the word should be taken literally. You think, Eid said. And are you so much cleverer than the alchemist who have puzzled over it for centuries? Perhaps not, Trude granted, though history boasts many so-called scholars of only middling ability. No, not cleverer, but more disposed to take risks. What risk did you take? I went to Golfaga. The city that had once lain in the shadow of the Dreadmount, now buried under ash. My grandsire told us he was going to visit Wilgastrom, Trude said, but he died of the draconic plague contracted in Galthaga. My father told me the truth when I was 15. I rode to the buried city myself to see what had driven my grandsire there. The world believed that the late Duke of Zeodor had died of the pox. Doubtless the family had been commanded to uphold the lie to avoid creating panic. Galthaga has never been excavated, but there is a way through the tuff, to the ruins, Trude said. Some ancient texts have survived. I found the ones my grandsire had been studying. You went to Galthaga knowing the draconic plague was there. You are mad, child. It is why I was sent to Innis, to learn temperance. But as you have seen, Mistress Durian, temperance is not my patron knight, Trude smiled. Mine is courage. He had waited. My ancestor was Viceroy of Orissima. From her journals, I learned that the comet that ended the grief of ages, that came the hour the worms fell, also gave strength to the eastern dragons. Her eyes were bright. My grandsire knew a little of the ancient language of Galthaga. He translated some of the astronomical writings. They revealed that this comet, the long-haired star, causes a starfall each time it passes. And what has this to do with anything else, pray tell? I think it connects to the tablet of Rumlabar. I think the comet is supposed to keep the fire beneath the world in check, Trude said. The fire builds over time, and then a starfall cools it, before it can grow too strong. Yet it grows strong now. Where is your comet? That is the problem. I believe that at some point in history, something upset the cycle. Now the fire grows too strong, too fast for the comet to subdue it. You believe, Eid said, frustrated. As others believe in gods. Often with less proof, Trude pointed out. We were lucky in the grief of ages. The coming of the long-haired star coincided with the rise of the draconic army. It saved us then, but by the time it comes again, Fyrdell will have conquered humankind. She grabbed Eid by the wrist, eyes flashing. The fire will rise as it did before, when the Nameless One was born into this world. Until it has consumed us all.
Her face was wrought with conviction, her jaw tight with it.
That, she finished with an air of triumph, is why I believe he will return, and why I think the House of Berethnet has naught to do with it.
They locked gazes for a long moment. Eid pulled her wrist free.
I want to pity you, child, she said, but I find my heart cold. You have fished in the waters of history and arranged some fractured pieces into a picture that gives your grandsire's death some meaning. But your determination to make it truth does not mean it is so. It is my truth. Many have died for your truth, Lady Trude. I trust, Eid said, that you can live with that.
A draught shivered through the arrow slit. Trude turned away from the chill, rubbing her arms.
Go to Queen Sebran, Eid. Leave me to my beliefs, and I will leave you to yours, she said. We will see soon enough whose truth is correct.
As she walked back to the Queen Tower, Eid winnowed her memories for the exact words that had been scored into the tablet of Rumalabar. The first two lines eluded her, but she recalled the rest. Fire ascends from the earth. Light descends from the sky. Too much of one doth inflame the other, and in this is the extinction of the universe. A riddle. The sort of nonsense alchemists bickered over for want of anything more useful to do. Bored with her privileged existence, the girl had passed her own meaning from the words. And yet, Eid found herself dwelling on it. After all, fire did ascend from the earth, through worms, and through the orange tree. Mages ate of its fruit, becoming vessels of the flame. Had the southerners of ancient times known some truth that had disappeared from history? Uncertainty threw shadows on her mind. If there was some connection between the tree and the comet and the Nameless One, surely the Priory would know of it. But so much knowledge had been lost over centuries, so many records destroyed. Eid cast the thought aside as she entered the royal apartments. She would think on the girl in the tower no more. In the great bedchamber, the Queen of Innis sat upright in her bed, nursing a cup of almond milk. As Eid sat beside the fire, braiding her hair, she felt Sebran's gaze like the tip of a knife.
You took their side.
Eid stopped. Madam? You agreed with Roz and Kate about the name. Days had passed since that discussion. This must have been curdling inside her ever since. I wanted my child to carry some part of her father, Sebran said bitterly. Morose it might be, but it is the place where we were last together, where he learned that we would have a daughter, where he vowed that she would be beloved. Compunction waxed in Eid.
I wanted to support you, she said, but I thought Lady Roslaine was right about not breaking with tradition. I still do.
She tied off her braid.
Forgive me, Majesty.
With a sigh, Sebran patted the bed. Come, the night is cold. Eid stood with a nod. Ascalon Palace did not hold warmth so well as Briar House. She blew out all but two of the candles before she got under the coverlets.
You are not yourself, Sebran inferred. What troubles you, Eid?
A girl with a skull full of dangerous ideas.
Only the talk of invasion, Eid answered. These are uncertain times.
Times of treachery. Sagoso has betrayed not only the saint, but humankind. Sebran exerted a stranglehold on her cup.
Innis survived the grief of ages, but barely. Villages were turned to ash, cities set afire. Our population was decimated, and even centuries later, any armies I can muster will not be as large as those we had before.
She put the cup aside. I cannot think of this now. I must deliver Glorian. Even if all three High Westerns lead their forces to my queendom, the Nameless One cannot join them. Her nightgown was drawn back to her bare belly, as if to let the child breathe. Blue veins traced her sides. I prayed to the damsel, asking her to fill my womb. Sebran released her breath. I can be no good queen, no good mother. Today, for the first time, I almost resented her.
The damsel? Never. The damsel does what she must.
One pale hand came to rest on the bump.
I resent my unborn child, an innocent. Her voice strained. The people already turn to her as their next queen, Eid. They speak of her beauty and her magnificence. I did not expect that. The suddenness of it. Once she is born, my purpose is served.
Madam, Eid said gently, that is not true, is it not?
Sabran circled a hand on her belly.
Glorian will soon come of age, and I will be expected, sooner or later, to abdicate in her favour, when the world considers me too old.
Not all Barethnet queens have abdicated,